And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with some music, and this is Them Heavy People by Kate Bush from her album, The Kick Inside. And that was Them Heavy People by Kate Bush from the album The Kick Inside. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We are going to look at a club that is active at McGill University, and that is the McGill Permaculture Club, which basically operates out at the St. Anne de Bellevue campus of McGill, the McDonald campus. And I sat down with Joel Harms right there in a food forest that the Permaculture Club has been maintaining, I guess, for a few years now. And what is permaculture? Permaculture is an approach to land management and philosophy that adopts arrangements observed in flourishing natural ecosystems. So it basically looks at nature, tries to copy some of the patterns that we see in nature, but harness them for efficient agriculture. It includes a set of design principles derived using whole systems thinking. And it uses these principles in fields such as regenerative agriculture, rewilding, and community resilience. So, the development of these agricultural ecosystems are intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient. The way I usually think of permaculture is permanent agriculture. So the type of agriculture that is not so much replanting every year your crops and sort of disturbing the soil by plowing the soil and that kind of thing, and putting chemical fertilizers in the soil and using pesticides, but instead, creating something like a food forest where it's fruit trees, but then underneath the fruit trees are berry bushes or dwarf fruit trees, and then below that is other areas that we could have or that you could plant beneficial plants like rhubarb or chives or who knows what. Something good, something edible, something medicinal, something that works well with fruit trees and berry bushes. And then on top of that, you could have your chickens grazing. I don't know if grazing is the right term, but you could have your chickens eating in between these rows of fruit trees and berry bushes and various other plants. So you kind of try to imitate what a natural ecosystem would do, and a natural ecosystem is very layered, and that's my idea of permaculture. But of course, there are a number of different approaches to permaculture, and it all depends on where you are in the world, what your climate is, and so on. But it's always been something that I've been fascinated by, and that I try to imitate sometimes in my own gardening. So I decided to speak to somebody who is a McGill student who works with the Permaculture Club. So that person is Joel Harms. So here is that interview. This is Ryan Young with Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I'm here with Joel Harms, who is involved with the McGill Permaculture Club out at McDonald Campus in St. Anne of Bellevue. And he's the garden manager in the club. And how are you doing today, Joel?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And he's an undergrad student. And what are you studying?
Bioresource engineering, actually. Yes.
Nice.
I'm in my third year now. Almost finished the third year.
Cool. So how did you get involved in the McGill Permaculture Club?
I think I got... I found out about them on the club fair, actually, which was back in 2018 when I came to Mac Campus. And I had heard a little bit about permaculture before, but I didn't really, I guess, consider actually practicing it. But I saw the club and I went there, and it was a nice community and they had a nice garden. And so I thought, why not get involved? And now I stuck around. Yeah.
Nice. So obviously you've seen the garden. Well, I guess there's a number of different places that you have things growing. So maybe describe each site.
Okay, yeah. So where we are right now is the food forest, as we call it, just generally because we have mostly trees here, mostly fruiting trees. And this is in Senville. But we also have another site, which is a bit younger, which is kind of our core site, which is the McGill Permaculture Showcase Garden is what it's called, and it's on the McDonald Campus Farm right behind the swine complex, about a quarter acre plot where we also have vegetables and flowers and also trees. But yeah, this site is mostly trees.
And the neighbors right beside you are also the McDonald Student Garden project,
the,
right?
The MSEG, yeah, right. Exactly.
Nice.
They're very good neighbors, helping us out a lot.
Nice. So so I guess this site that we're actually sitting in, mm-hmm. Which is near Jardin Caria, which is an organic farm in Senneville. Do you know when this was planted?
I think in 2016 about. We've only been helping manage it since last year. So since 2020, actually, I think, or maybe 2019. I'm not sure, but we haven't been doing very much here yet. So far, so it's still kind of wild.
And when you got involved with the McGill Permaculture Club, it was still a pretty new club, was it not?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was founded probably 2017, might have been the first season. I came, I think during the second full season, right after the second full season, 2018, if I remember correctly. I think 2017 is the right date.
And why do you think the McGill Permaculture Club was formed?
I think, like, our main purpose that we see is to, to educate, to get people to put permaculture on the map so that it's not something that is unknown anymore, and especially among, like, the student community who will take that out then into the world with them. I think that's our main kind of objective.
And when you look at the description of the club on the website, or maybe it's part of student activities or something like that, it does state that it was partly formed in relationship to the fact that the McDonald campus does not promote in the programs that you're taking any kind of permaculture type farming.
Yeah, that's true. We're actually not seeing a lot of courses or activities that relate to organic or farming or even permaculture. So, MSEG kind of put a start to, like, putting ecological farming on the map, like vegetables mainly, and then I guess that's definitely part of it.
And so, is there pressure to get the campus to, or the school, whatever department it is, to provide a course in permaculture, and have you had any success?
I think there may have been talk about it at some point, but I'm not sure if there's anything happening now at the moment. No, I'm not sure about that.
So then the fact that it's sort of more of a club, tell me what kind of activities that you've seen happen since you've been involved.
Okay, what was nice, a very nice thing that we started doing in 2019 was we had interns from actually courses, people that needed to complete like a small project for a course or something. They were able to intern with us and do a small project. We had a GIS intern, so we got both of our gardens mapped. I think we even had two GIS interns actually, and some other interns doing like projects around the garden, and that really started going. And then last year, we changed our bed structure actually. We kind of tried to go for a different style of beds so that we could make more use of the space that we had to kind of concentrate our vegetables together in the space, and also maybe make it easier to manage. And it turned out quite well. We were able to achieve a very nice yield, and we aren't even using half of the vegetable bed area that we used before.
Nice. What do you like most about permaculture? What interests you most about permaculture?
You know, sometimes when we think of sustainability or something, we think of we have to give something up in order to be sustainable or to be green. But kind of with permaculture, with the conscious design you can do, you can actually achieve sustainability without giving up on the efficiency, without giving up on yield, because you actually can achieve almost greater yields dependent. I mean, the studies are pending, so yeah, just from experience, I guess.
And have you ever had a nice experience where you taste something great in a food forest or something like that? And tell me about that experience.
All the time. Every year, actually, I still discover new things that I didn't know were edible in our permaculture garden. I think last year there was some plant. I'm not so good with the names, but kind of with the mustardy leaves that you can add to salads or anything. And even if you're in the field, I like, you know, the plants I know that are edible to taste them. And we have agastache, for example, that I haven't heard about before I came to the permaculture club, which is Korean mint also, or anise mint, because it tastes like anise. But it's a mint, and we had pineapple sage in our garden. So it's sage, but it tastes of pineapple, or lemon basil. That is also a very interesting kind of type. and everything's edible. And in a permaculture system, actually everything is edible to some degree. So, yeah.
Very interesting. As a student in bioresource engineering, what are some of your other interests?
So I do work right now for Professor Adamowski and together with Dr. Julian Millard, who just graduated, so just got his PhD. And what we're doing is we're trying to build models that integrate both social aspects and hydrological aspects of modeling into one overall model so that we can better manage water resources. And so we've done some like coding work. But then on my own time, I guess I like looking at so-called holistic management or holistic planned grazing, which is a very nice system developed by Alan Savory. And so I'm trying to learn about that. And yeah, because it's quite beautiful in that it integrates animals with human needs and finds a better way to manage grasslands using just observing like the cycles in nature. And where Alan Savory realized animals in nature are constantly moving, so we should also constantly move our animals. And it turns out you can actually do this in any type of climate. He has even practiced it in deserts with, I think, just 200 millimeters of precipitation in a year. So, and it revitalizes the grasslands, I guess. And suddenly where there was bare ground, grass comes back up because we need the animals to complete the nutrient cycle, I guess, yeah.
And do you think that overall in Canada, or maybe North America in general, or in the Western world, that agriculture is a problematic practice in many ways, and like in terms of, you know, the conventional approach to agriculture, which I think you're learning a lot about by being in the bioresource engineering program?
Yeah, it's true. We definitely do mostly focus on that, also in our courses on irrigation, I guess, or fertilization or whatever. Yeah, and I do believe it. There is certain problems, and I think maybe one of the beginning problems is that even the farmers that are practicing it are having trouble to feed themselves a lot of the time because the system is not very resilient, and there's more and more inputs needed as time goes on, and it's not the soil is losing its health and losing its biodiversity, and once we start losing the biodiversity, then the system becomes very weak and easily attacked by all kinds of pests, and that really puts a detriment to is a weak point, I guess, in the food system at the moment.
And what originally attracted you to take a program like bioresource engineering?
Well, I was thinking a lot about what I wanted to do, I guess, once I'm out of high school. And I thought I want to work outside if I can. And so I was looking at all the environmental fields. And then I realized that most of the work that is involved in being in an environmental science kind of field is to find problems, things that are going wrong. And I didn't want to just do that. I wanted to be able to change something about it, I guess. So that's why I chose bioresource engineering, because engineers solve problems. Yeah.
And did you grow up on the West Island, or?
No, not at all, actually. I was born in Germany and moved around there a bit. And then in 2013, we actually came to Kelowna. So in British Columbia, actually. So very different kind of Canada, full of wine and orchards. So not so much. I guess here is a bit colder, but yeah. Now I'm here for school, I guess, to study at McGill.
And, you know, Germany has been pretty advanced as countries go when it comes to supporting organic agriculture and some of these more innovative approaches that are more sustainable. Are you aware of that? Do you pay attention to it?
I guess growing up there, mostly I think I've picked up some things. I mean, there's a general more awareness, I think, about organic foods and things like that, and generally environment. But I think one thing that's happening also with the EU is it makes it so easy to import organic products from faraway countries like Spain, where they're grown basically in the deserts with use of huge amounts of plastic and refugee labor, which is also kind of iffy. And then these are imported to Germany instead of growing it locally, which is which would probably be more sustainable, even if it's not quite like organic or whatever. So the organic forces it to import from far away instead of taking local things sometimes. And that, I think, is maybe not too good. Yeah.
And I mean, the one thing I had heard was that in terms of subsidies, government subsidies in agriculture, here, you know, the organic farmer really gets no subsidies at all, generally speaking. And then the conventional farmer does get all the subsidies. And so my understanding was that in Germany, they more allocate some subsidies to farmers that are organic.
There was talk about that, but there was a proposed law that would support sustainable agriculture, but I don't think it passed. So the subsidies are distributed based on area of land farmed. So bigger farms get more subsidies, no matter what kind of production they use. Yeah.
Okay. And what about renewable energy in Germany?
I think Germany's quite far ahead with like renewable energies, but they also have a very high energy cost. So the companies are moving away, even though now there's regenerative energy. So it's kind of a plus, it didn't just bring positives, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. So back to permaculture. Hmm. What do you think obviously, maybe we could discuss this first, how the pandemic has obviously changed the activities of the McGill Permaculture Club, and then what you're hoping to maybe achieve or at least do this year and maybe going into the following year, even though, you know, so many kind of social activities related to mm-hmm. permaculture maybe not be as easy.
Yeah, we really... we couldn't have, of course, any like in-person meetings, which was, we usually have a lot of potlucks and things like that, and it was kind of hard to give that up. But what we did instead, we had a lecture series, actually, or a seminar series. We had eight speakers so far, I think. We had...
All online.
All online, yes, exactly. But about very interesting topics. We had some people from the club participate who were doing PhD research. We had Dr. Julian Millard, who just finished his PhD, talk about his PhD and about some future projects. He actually had two seminars with us. And yeah, then it was very nice to do that. So that's kind of the social side, what we're doing. And now this year, we're bringing back the internship. We're trying to bring more people into the garden. We have a cooperation with the John Abbott Harvest Club, actually. They're helping us out in the garden. What's a little bit difficult is to always see the changing, restrictions or protocols. And we always have to coordinate that with the McDonald Campus Farm because I guess we're on their land. So yeah, it's maybe that's a bit complicated. So we don't know exactly how it's going to be. It's a bit difficult to plan right now, but we're also running the garden as more of a community garden this year. So instead of the whole club taking care of all beds, people can apply to us and take care of one bed by themselves. And I guess we also limit contact that way. It's, I guess, more easy to get approval for activities then. And then everybody takes care of their bed and keeps their harvest. And yeah. Running it like that. And I think it's maybe better to have people like kind of be engaged because it's in their plot of land and they'll take care of it more eagerly.
And was there an intern last year in 2020?
In 2020 we barely kept like the operation going. We changed the bed structure a bit, but that was kind of the only thing we were able to do. And so we had a good harvest. We refertilized all the beds, did like recomposted them. So that's how we fertilize. And so yeah, that's kind of what happened last year. Last year was kind of a slower year, I guess.
And when you're out there, do you have to wear a mask or no?
I don't know what the restrictions are for the moment for the garden, like at the farm.
But so, here, obviously. You
would well, here it's kind of, I guess we make the rules, we stay apart, so yeah. I guess we don't have to, but yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't think so, because we're outside. I wouldn't see why we would have to.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I don't know the exact procedures at the moment. Yeah.
And if you were to point out some sort of fruiting tree or fruiting bush that you particularly like, since you've been doing some of this permaculture, what would it be?
I think, okay, for fruiting, oh, there's so many good plants. It's hard to pick a favorite. I think I really like the blackberries, just because they're very tasty, and the ones in our garden are doing quite well, and really, really good blackberries we get from that. But if it's non-fruiting, we had yarrow, actually. I think it's yarrow, yeah, which is a very nice plant we had. It also kind of grows in a bush, very nice flowering bush. And actually, the indigenous people of North America used the leaves to like tend to wounds and things. And, you know, you're in a garden, you sometimes get some nicks and scratches and whatever. And I've tried it out, and it does work. It's quite nice.
Nice. And do you plan to, like, so where we are here, I'm looking at kind of raised beds with fruit trees on them and some bushes, like berry bushes and so on. Do you have any plans to do anything to radically change this setup, or just work with what you have?
No, I think I guess we call them swales, they kind of keep the water from running off. We want to keep them around. They're very nice, like permaculture building, I guess, or like construction, earthworks is what we call it. And yeah, they really help the trees because it keeps the water in, and that would be water that we would otherwise just be running off. And so I think we're going to keep it largely the same, just maybe clean it up a bit, put some more vegetables in. Well, vegetables, I mean herbs, mainly like chives, because fruit trees really benefit from those, and also mints, because they keep away pests, namely like the Japanese beetle and things like that, because I guess they don't like the smell of onions. Yeah.
Okay, very interesting. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Joel.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And that was my interview with Joel Harms from the Permaculture Club of McGill, or the McGill Permaculture Club. And they have a garden, a demonstration garden out at McDonald Campus in St. Anne de Bellevue. A lot of fruits are becoming ripe. Anyone who's got cherries or sour cherries, you know, trees on their properties, or knows of one in the community, I'm hitting some of those now myself, and I've got a couple of choice sour cherry trees that I'm visiting, as well as Juneberries, or in French, amelanchier, or another term is serviceberry. I've been going to many of the serviceberries around where I live to eat serviceberries, and, you know, people see me picking these berries, and they say, "What is he doing? You know, who is this weirdo?" You know, and most people are not even aware of the fruit called a Juneberry or a serviceberry, and that it's edible. But it is. So, you know, that's urban foraging. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Later on in the show, we're going to feature some stuff from the Goldman Environmental Prize website. Recently, they announced or awarded 6 people with the Goldman Environmental Prize, and we're going to feature some of the audio about 2 of those individuals later on towards the end of the show. But before that, I'd like to play you an interview I did a while back, a few years ago, with Francois Reeves. And Francois Reeves is a doctor. He's a cardiologist, and he wrote a book called Planète Cœur, Santé Cardiaque et Environnement. Apparently, there's also an English version of the book called Planète Heart, How an Unhealthy Environment Leads to Heart Disease, which came out in 2014 from Greystone Books. So essentially, he's a doctor that raises awareness about air pollution and, you know, environmental toxins and so on, and your heart health. We're going to play that interview now.
This is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Dr. Francois Reeves, who is a interventional cardiologist. How are you doing today, Francois?
Just fine. It's a great meeting.
Absolutely. I was really floored by a lot of the research that you presented in your presentation. How close are the links between bad cardiovascular health and a bad environment?
Well, with the last research, mainly in the 20 years, we have many, many robust evidence to show us that depending where you live, you may multiply by 10 the risk of having a heart attack. For instance, if you compare statistics over all Europe, in Switzerland, your risk of having a heart attack for a man between 25 to 64 is about 60 per 100,000 population. In Ukraine, it's 10 times this odd. And it's not only gene, it's not only life habits, but it's also environment, and it's a major part now. And now it's better estimated. The WHO published last year that the excess of death caused by air pollution was 7 million deaths in 2012. So those are major odds, major issues that we should address seriously.
And for example, I thought about how you directed attention in this area. For example, myself, I eat healthy, right? I try and make sure that everything I eat is organic. I eat good quality, or I drink good quality water. But in fact, in terms of kilograms of what I'm taking in day to day, I'm taking in more air than I am food. Is that right?
And a lot more air. In fact, you will eat in average about 1 kilogram of food, but you will breath about 10 to 20 kilogram of air a day. And the calculation is very easy to make. 1,000 liters of air weight 1 kilogram, and you'll breathe, because you breathe continuously, about 10 to 20,000 liters of air. So it represents 10 to 20 kilograms of air. And with such an exposition, that's the reason why the air should be clean, as simple as that.
And in terms of, I guess that most of this research has been done in the United States, but really the cardiovascular health of people is very bad in the parts of the U.S. that are very industrialized versus the parts that are not. Is this not true?
Totally true. And in fact, the worst place, and environmentally speaking, the more pollution you get, the more heart disease and stroke you will get, and by very big odds, you know. So that's why we should do everything to prevent either those pollutants to get in our air, the right to have a clean air as the right to have a clean water, but also to not only stop producing them, but filtering and absorbing them. And that's why trees are so important in our cities. They are major, major air filter. We all recognize the role of the trees and forests to clear, to clean, to purify water. It's the same for air. And it's just only recently, for let's say the 20 last years, that all the researchers, the biologists, the botanists, recognize the fact that trees are a powerful air cleaner. And that's the main reason for which it's so efficient to protect our health, because it cleans air.
And not only does it clean air, but of course it regulates the temperature, cools things off. How can that have a positive impact?
Well, we all know that mortality is always exacerbated when it's too cold or too hot. And you know that in the desert, the brutal difference between day and night, during day it's burning and during night it's freezing. But when you have trees, it will temper everything. Thus, you have a better milieu to by tempering those excess of temperature either in winter or in summer. You know, when you're doing cross-country skiing and it's really cold and windy, you'd better be in the forest rather than in the middle of the lake. So it's exactly the same process for the quality of life, especially for vulnerable population, meaning the kids, babies, and older people and people with chronic diseases.
And the heat effect also affects ozone. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a simple, it's the chemist will explain that. It's simply by a thermal reaction. When you burn fossil fuels, for instance, the gas in the car, you will emit ozone amongst a lot of other pollutants. And we know now that if you emit this ozone at 56 degrees of temperatures, and I mean in Fahrenheit, because the studies was presented in Fahrenheit, if you go up to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, you will triple the amount of ozone. So if you have a coolest milieu, done mainly by the trees, for instance, with the same amount of fossil fuel use, you will have less ozone if it's cooler than if it's warmer.
Wow, that's amazing. And in terms of the situation where studies have shown that in those areas that are industrialized, where cardiovascular health is bad, a little bit of help from trees has had a big impact.
So there's a lot of study demonstrating a positive and incredible effects of trees in our milieu to protect our cardiovascular health. I think the most spectacular study was published by two Scottish scientists, Popham and Mitchell. It was published in The Lancet in 2008. That's old stuff. But they followed 40 million people in Great Britain, and they compare according to their income and according to the exposure to green spaces. And globally, you have a 6% reduction of cardiovascular disease in the green milieu. But moreover, if you compare rich to poor in a greener milieu, you have a reduction by half of the difference of cardiovascular death that are usually that you can attribute to the income. So it has really a tempering effect of the inequalities of poor and rich in front of the disease. And the environment really do that.
And you talked about how, of course, the environment isn't the only thing that affects people's health. There's, you know, what you eat, your genetics, and so on and so forth. But how a lot of where you are affects what you do and how you do it.
Yes, indeed. And usually the American School of Medicine looks at two things, your genes and your lifestyle, your habits. And we should really add the environment part instead in this dynamic. So everything you do, if it's contaminated, well, let's take a simpler example. About 200 years ago, Louis Pasteur in France explained to everybody around that there are some microorganisms that we can't see, but they may kill you. Imagine 200 years ago how people received that. Now, the challenge has moved. It's not the microaggressors, because we know quite well what's going on. Look at the crisis of the Ebola crisis, but it was mastered quite rapidly. The main problem now is the nano-aggressors. So the small particles you may have either in your food, in your water, or in the air. And those nano-aggressors are really potent, and they explain how come everywhere in the where you have an industrial revolution based mainly on fossil fuels, you have this high rate of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. We did not recognize that, let's say, 20, 30 years ago, but now it's all the science is there to first to realize that, it's the first thing, and then to take measures.
So as a doctor, I mean, even though you're saying the science is there now, do you still sometimes have trouble putting this across in the medical community, or do you feel like you're one of the first people to sort of draw attention to this as a doctor?
Well, first people know, because there are specialists in environmental health for centuries, if you know. But to recognize the cardiovascular part, which is so important, if you talk about pollution, people will think about asthma, pulmonary disease. That's normal. But it's really more than that. And you got cerebrovascular disease, you got cardiovascular disease. In fact, you got a lot of disease. Since I am a cardiologist, I will focus on what I know very well. It's a matter of credibility, of science credibility. But it's always the same phenomenon. And when I mentioned during my lectures, my course, my seminars, by the way, the four medicine faculties in Quebec all invite me because of this subject, and it's quite new for physicians to hear about environment, and not only because you are exposed to, let's say, asbestos, but to usual stuff like air pollution, like what's going out of the exhaust of your car. And now we have this science, and when you mention all the high-rank publication where all those studies are coming from, I mean Nature, I mean Science, I mean Cell, I mean the New England Journal of Medicine, I mean the Lancet, you see, all big stuff. And all the science is there, and we have a growing body of evidence showing us that, yes, we should control this environment, and we have corrupted this environment, and now it's time to look at this. Downtown Toronto, downtown Montreal are the two dirtiest places of Canada, and we should address that.
And so as a doctor, what keeps you motivated? Why are you interested in putting time and energy into this topic?
I think that you have doctors that are talking about obesity, sedentarity, smoking, life habits. There's not that much doctors in the field of environment. I feel it very important. There are billions of dollars invested in research about gene. But I can tell you, you can't that much change your and my genes. Okay, but you can change totally the environment. And if you see billion of dollars invest in genes, which is okay, I'm for research, scientific medical research, that's okay for me, but we should have the balance to have more investment in environment, in environmental health, and how we can address the issues of those nano aggressors in order to not to need me. As a cardiologist, I think I'm okay. I'm good. I will pamper you if you have a problem. But really, what you prefer is never need me. Really. So that's the reason. It's a major issue in terms of prevention. First, we should be aware of that. We should be kept informed. And we should see also how to influence that. And that's why I'm happy to be amongst councils at the Ministry of Environment of Quebec. I'm part of the advisory board. I met a lot of minister councils, of mayors. So I think, especially for mayors, you have the federal, provincial, and the cities. But I think the mayors are the most potent people according to improving the quality of your milieu, and then to influence positively their own population. So I think the mayors are key people about that.
Well, thanks so much for speaking to us today.
Rip, pleasure. Thanks again.
And that was my interview with Dr. Francois Reeves, who is an interventional cardiologist and associate professor of medicine with a joint appointment in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the University of Montreal. He is the author of Planet Cur, or in English, Planet Heart, How an Unhealthy Environment Leads to Heart Disease, which came out in 2014 from Greystone Books. Hope you enjoyed that interview. So now I'd like to look at two of the recipients of the Goldman Environmental Prize. One of them is from Vietnam, and that's Thai Van Nguyen. And he founded the Save Vietnam's Wildlife Organization, which rescued over 1,500 pangolins from the illegal wildlife trade between 2014 and 2020. And he also established Vietnam's first anti-poaching unit, which since 2018 has destroyed 9,700 animal traps and confiscated 78 guns and arrested 558 people for poaching, leading to a significant decline in illegal activities in Pumat National Park.
With their coat of armor and reclusive habits, pangolins do their best to avoid trouble. These scaly mammals, found in Asia and Africa, hide away in the day and spend their nights dining on ants and termites.
The pangolin is a special species. They are harmless and shy. When threatened, they curl up in a ball to protect themselves with their hard outer scales.
But pangolins are the world's most trafficked species. It's estimated that over 1 million have been poached worldwide in the past decade. Vietnam is a particular hotspot.
Pangolins are killed for their meat as a delicacy and for their scales to be used in traditional Chinese medicine. But there is no scientific evidence that their meat is nutritious or that their scales have medicinal value. Seeing the disappearance of pangolins, I felt that extinction was coming, and they could soon vanish forever.
Determined to protect this critically endangered animal, Thai Van Nguyen founded Save Vietnam's Wildlife in 2014, a nonprofit dedicated to conservation, education, and advocacy, as well as rescue and rehabilitation.
The biggest challenge in pangolins protection is changing the mindset and habits of the Vietnamese people. When I started working on pangolin conservation, almost no one knew anything about them. Now, not only do more people know about them, but they love them and want to protect them.
Thai then turned his attention to Vietnam's illegal pangolin trade.
So we built an anti-poaching team with the aim of assisting government agencies in strengthening law enforcement.
Thai personally trained the rangers. They patrol 330,000 acres of forest, destroying illegal camps and traps. Their work has led to an 80% decrease in illegal activities. Rehabilitating rescued pangolins is also a high priority.
After rescuing pangolins, we take care of them, feed them, cure them from diseases, and then release them back into the wild.
In just a few years, Thai has brought global awareness to the pangolin's plight, becoming the face of pangolin protection worldwide. Using this influence, he helped broker an international ban on the illegal trade. But there is more work to be done. Now, with the Vietnamese government's support, Thai is developing policies that he hopes will bring pangolins back to their rightful place in the forest.
Working with pangolins is my greatest passion. It's a joy to dedicate myself to the restoration and protection of this wild species.
For outstanding environmental achievement for Asia, the 2021 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Thai Van Nguyen, Cuc Phu, Vietnam.
That was audio from a video from the Goldman Environmental Prize website. Thai Van Nguyen is one of the winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize this year. The other one I wanted to feature on today's show was Sharon Levine. And Sharon Levine is a special education teacher turned environmental justice advocate who successfully stopped the construction of a 1.25 billion plastics manufacturing plant alongside the Mississippi River in St. James Parish in Louisiana. So this is the audio from a little history sort of bio video that the Goldman Environmental Prize people produced.
When I was growing up as a little girl, we lived the American dream, and we lived off the land, and we had clean air, clean water, and everything was so wonderful, and we weren't sick.
St. James Parish sits on both sides of the Mississippi River, protected by the same levees that failed New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. But other forces have threatened the community for generations. Sharon Levine was one of the first to call attention to the issue.
But 3 or 4 years ago, I lost my neighbor on my right side, and I lost a neighbor on my left side, both from cancer. These industries are poisoning our air, they're poisoning our water.
With over 150 petrochemical plants along an 80-mile stretch of the river, the region has among the highest concentrations of toxic chemicals in the United States. And the predominantly African-American community has cancer rates 50 times higher than the national average, lending the area the morbid nickname, Cancer Alley.
We were going to the health meetings.
I have grandchildren that are sick right now.
We'd live in anger and despair and hopelessness. And so we were angry inside, just angry, roaring.
Sharon didn't have experience as an activist. But in November 2018, when the Chinese chemical company Wanhua proposed construction of a plastics plant in St. James Parish, she mobilized her neighbors against it.
We had almost 20 people in the garage. I'm sitting up there directing the meeting, didn't know what in the world I was doing. The more they said there was no hope, the more something inside of me riled up.
This project will have devastating effects.
Sharon decided to dedicate herself to working full-time for environmental justice. She founded Rise St. James and soon proved herself to be a natural leader.
We get the word out by doing media work on the radio. Billboards, flyers, ads in the newspaper, letters to the parish council members. We do a lot of education to the public.
Thanks to the intense grassroots campaign that Rise St. James carried out, Wanhua halted construction of the $1.25 billion plastics plant in September 2019.
And we were so happy and excited when the parish council would not accept their application. The people in the community spoke up. That was victory to me.
That victory helped prevent the generation of 1 million pounds of liquid hazardous waste each year and protected residents from additional air and water pollution. But before Rise could hit pause, Formosa Plastics, a Taiwan-based corporation, announced its plan to build a factory a mile from Sharon's home.
We're gonna stop Formosa. I don't care what nobody say, the governor, anyone, I'm not afraid. God told me Formosa is not going to do that to us.
For outstanding environmental achievement for North America, the 2021 Goldman Environmental Prize is awarded to Sharon Levine, St. James Parish, Louisiana.
And that was audio from a video about Sharon Levine, who is one of the 2021 Goldman Prize recipients. And she is a special education teacher turned environmental justice advocate. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks for listening to the show. So you can also follow our show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUT Montreal. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young. And you can follow me on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. We're going to leave you with some music, and there was a band that was formed around Bill Bruford, the famous jazz fusion slash progressive rock drummer who played in King Crimson for a while, and he later formed his own jazz fusion sort of band, which featured Alan Holdsworth on guitar, and they did a tune back in the 80s, I believe, called 5G. It's an instrumental, and I don't like 5G. I think 5G is going to cause some problems down the road. But when this song was done, they were obviously not referring to 5G in terms of Wi-Fi or computers or the internet. But this song is called 5G. So we're going to leave you with that. Have a great rest of your day. We'll be right back.
Babies and Mr. Blue invites you to a barbecue on Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day, Thursday, June 24th, from noon to 9 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park in Côte des Neiges, corner of Côte Saint-Catherine and Westbury. Weather permitting, come out and enjoy. On the menu, doubles, roti, jerk pork and chicken, curry goat and chicken, lots of side dishes. Wear your mask, social distancing required. That's Thursday, June 24th, noon to 9 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park in Côte des Neiges. For more information, call 514-771-7011.
Nous sommes des millions à parler français, une langue vibrante qui façonne notre culture. La Fondation canadienne pour le dialogue des cultures est fière de présenter la troisième édition de Tout pour la musique, une vitrine des célébrations de la Saint-Jean-Baptiste. Diffusé par UNITV, ce spectacle invite à s'unir et à manifester notre fierté d'être francophone. Ici Jean-François Brault. Le 24 juin à 21h, heure de l'Est, ne manquez pas le spectacle Tout pour la musique en direct sur UNITV. J'y serai avec Vincent Vallière, Radio Radio, Roxane Bruno, Willows et bien d'autres. Visitez le tplm.ca pour plus de détails.
In Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what? Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots rock reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune in to CKUT, always.
Spread your wings.
Once.